fourth class in the series of six classes in a day long. And we will start tonight with, just leave that open 5 more minutes. We'll start tonight with a half an hour sitting, and I will give the instructions for that sitting and for the week tonight, and also review the instructions that were from previous nights together. So by this time, I expect all of us to know how to sit, and just with a little bit of review, keeping that back straight, relaxed but straight, and remembering that if you're on a chair, not to rest your back against the back of the chair, but swing outward with your feet parallel to one another. Hands can be folded in the lap or on your knees or whatever is a comfortable position for you. And so we begin by releasing the day. Isn't it amazing what we carry? So just, and we just do it absent-mindedly, because at any particular moment we have the ability to release ourselves from that tension. But in some ways the tension gives us purpose. The purpose being overcoming the struggle, feeling as if we're getting somewhere. But just releasing it, just feeling the burden and the release of that burden. And noticing the qualitative difference between what we carry into this class and when we sit down, the releasing ourselves from that burden, the qualitative difference between those two. So softening the eyes, the jaw, relaxing the shoulders away from the neck, and unrounding them so that the back is straight and curved. Softening the belly so that it's free of tension and becomes immediately available to our attention and our focus. As we breathe in, we notice the expansion of the abdominal area, and as we breathe out, we notice the contraction of that area and the sensations that are associated with both of those movements. Remembering that the definition of meditation is knowing what's occurring, knowing that breath is arising, knowing that we are sitting here. Then the second week of instructions had to do with whatever is a predominant physical sensation that calls our attention away from the breath, be it pleasant or unpleasant. And we may note that the qualities of pleasant or unpleasant or neutral accompany virtually every sensation that arises. And what we usually do with an unpleasant sensation is try to avoid it. What we do with a pleasant sensation is try to indulge it. And with a neutral sensation, we usually miss it entirely. So the quality, or in Buddhism it's called the feeling tone, the feeling tone, or the pleasant or unpleasant nature, quality of a sensation accompanies it. It's hardwired into the sensation itself. So we can begin to notice whether a sensation is pleasant or unpleasant, and it's immediate. You know whether it is. We don't have to reflect upon it. You see it immediately. And thereby you can be prepared that if there's an unpleasant sensation, that you're going to be trying to either eliminate it or avoid it, but unlikely will you want to go into it. And if it's a pleasant sensation, you will try to maintain its duration endlessly. And then it will pass away, end, as all sensations will, and our mind continues to go back to it as a memory, wanting to replicate it. And so we become lost in either the pleasant or the unpleasant. So just to notice that, just pain and itch, feelings of heat or cold or tingling. Then we expanded the field of our attention to include emotions as well. So if, as we were sitting, we began to experience an emotion, be it pleasant or unpleasant, and again, the feeling tone of pleasant or unpleasantness also accompanies an emotion. Irritability, frustration, fear, anger are considered by most people to be unpleasant emotions. Happiness, joy, well-being, contentment are obviously pleasant. So the question is, when we do feel that, can we remain in the body, not lost in the content of why we're feeling that or justification for feeling that, but rather just allowing the emotion to be felt as a physical sensation and as an accompanying mind state? But it's very important to stay grounded in the physical sensation, because the mind state will create a tendency to leave it and go into the abstract, thinking about it. So an emotion can just arise or fall in our sitting. No problem, no problem whatsoever. Just comes, stays for a while, and goes. And we need not hide from them. We don't have to be afraid of them. In fact, opening our heart to them is very much what we're trying to do in meditation. In meditation, we are not task-oriented. We're not trying to do something when something arises. We're not trying to fix it or change it or hope that it goes away or construct something with it. Meditation is a release from task-centered focus. Rather, it is about listening, about receiving what it is that's going on. And when we receive something, we don't have to do anything to it. We certainly don't have to influence or control it. We just open up to what it is. So the meditation is synonymous with receptivity, which is synonymous with listening, being available, accommodating. The mind can be like a trap door in which it squeezes everything out except and closes down to the message, or it can be like a swinging door which opens wide open. So we're bringing that door and swinging it open, wide open. And you'll find that no matter what arises in or through that door, you have the ability to open to it. Releasing ourselves from the judgment, from the identification, and just seeing and feeling it for what it is. This is authentic living, not projected living. Projected living, we see what our judgments condemn it to be. In authentic living, we see what is authentically there. This week, we're going to open up the field of our attention to include sounds. Just for the moment, just listen. Know you're listening. just hearing. What the ear hears, not what the mind thinks about what the ear hears. An airplane? Mind doesn't hear airplane, it hears this. I mean, the ears don't hear airplane, it just hears the sound. The mind thinks airplane, and then with that thought, it says, I wonder where that airplane's going. Sounds like a, does it not, doesn't sound like a jet, it must be prop plane. Hope it's not a crop duster carrying terrorists. See how you can just get lost in the abstraction. So just bring your attention back to what the ear hears, and nothing can annoy you. In fact, if annoyance occurs, the sound isn't coming in to annoy us, we're going out to annoy the sound. So if annoyance is there with the sound, just release that and just hear what the ear hears. And then when that becomes less intense, when the airplane flies by or when the cars quit passing on the street, then we can go back and resume our attention on our breath. Using the breath as an anchor when there isn't a competing or more predominant sensation present. Always returning to the breath if other things aren't occurring that call our attention away from it. Now all of this is done from a deep, fundamental sense of relaxation. The foundation of the practice, that sense of relaxation and ease, deep ease of being, ease of well-being. And if and when our mind gets lost in thought, which it will countless times, remember, before you go immediately back to the breath or to whatever the competing sensation is, first go through the body's relaxation and ease. And then let whatever it is that you're focusing on emerge from that sense of deep, tensionless ease. So knowing what we're doing, knowing what's occurring, sound is arising, breath is arising, pain. If it's helpful to give soft mental labels, sound, rising, falling, pain, rising, falling, itch, as a way to hold our attention upon what it is that we are seeing, in other words, to focus our knowing that this is occurring, then that can be useful. But don't get lost in trying to find the right word. Just relax and be simple and easy in this entire meditation. And now I'll be quiet and we'll sit for 15 minutes. We'll end the sitting with a poem, author unknown. Tread gently when you walk into my life, for around the body of my soul I have gathered fragile gossamer to the floor of little lies, not to deceive you, but to protect me. Do not pull at them to render my soul naked, for they hide truths I have not yet the strength to face. And when they are gone, I may perish in the cold realities of your judgment, I may die. But let me stand protected yet a while. Talk to me in love, and when I am secure in that, those lies will fall away as unneeded peel, revealing the fruit, the feast. May all beings relax into the truth. May all beings feel safe with the truth. May all beings release themselves from pretension. So as you remember from last week, we were in the room of our minds, and I'd like to take you back to that attic, mostly unkept attic. But before I do, I just want to reinforce what this practice is and has always been about, and that fundamentally the means that we use to get to whatever ends we are so motivated to pursue must be in alignment with those ends. For if the means work in counteract what the ends that we seek, then the means must be questioned. For instance, if we think that we'd like to be more loving, and we use the practice to further our self-abuse, then you can see from the start that the track or the path to a loving heart is not going to be through constant self-criticism that many of us live with. And so we have to be willing to suspend those means that are in contradiction to the ends that we are most longing to know or to receive. If we want to be free of pain, then we can't have a hardened attitude with which we practice the meditation. And so this meditation fundamentally is a meditation from and of the heart. Because all the things that most of us have come to meditation for are in parallel journey to the heart. All of the reasons that you gave the first day, I would like to have more clarity, more contentment, more ease, more relaxation, more space in my mind, less thinking, lots of different details were spoken about. All of those require a path from and of the heart to achieve. We are conditioned, most of us are conditioned, to believe that we are deserving of some punishment or penance. Because our lives have been less than ideally lived, that we have done many unforgiving things to ourselves and others, and we think that the practice should somehow, or it's often thought like this, it's not always, but somehow that the practice should be a kind of a form of penance to our past. And we look for, we can look for a practice that creates hardship on us. Whether it's being whacked by a stick, or whether it's internally the attitude with which we addressed the words and the instructions. So we have to be very careful of our tendency, because many of us start out disadvantaged in this way, feeling that we are deserving of some kind of punishment. We look for the practice to fulfill that prophecy. And the attitude with which we approach the practice can be and will confirm the hardness with which we have anticipated the practice. And so we have to be very careful that when we enter the room of the mind, we do so knowing that to be aligned with and to be gentle with everything we find in here, we have to approach it with a loving heart. This is extraordinarily important. Perhaps the most important thing I'll say the entire time we're together. How we come into this room is essential as to what we will glean from the contents, what we will understand, what we will take out, what we will actually achieve once we are here. That's why, as I mentioned, we come in with nothing but the light of our attention. Because the light is, as I shine it on your bodies, is completely neutral in its impact. So when we shine the light at the interior of our minds, we're going to find many discouraging qualities in this room. Many things that we would much rather not have as a part of me. And if I meet that with self-belligerence or the history of self-abuse, if I get upset with myself for having these qualities, we in fact generate the same qualities of negation, of abuse, back into the mind. It's a closed system. What you find in here and what you bring to it, it's a closed system. If you find something, your attitude with which you find it and the way you act with it remains in this room. So if you have hardness with what you find, I shouldn't be angry. What's the matter with me for being fearful? I've always been that. That foster, encourages, and cultivates the same qualities to be nurtured here in this room. And so we don't get out of anything, you see? There's no way to do that. So what qualities do we come in with that are essential? You see, the Buddha, someone once asked the Buddha, said, how will we know whether a practice is right? We've had lots of different people tell us that to practice this way and to practice that way and to practice the other. Often these statements are contradictory to one another. How will we ever know what's the right way to practice? And he said, by the heart. If it's for your benefit and for the benefit of all beings, then you know that the practice has some merit. If it serves you and doesn't disadvantage you, doesn't keep you tied down, doesn't keep you looking up in some kind of idealistic way, or doesn't hold you in a condemned position like a sinner, in which you will struggle forever against what? Against your own ideas. But rather, if the practice starts and bases itself in love. Let me show you an example. A practice, and there are many, can access wisdom, can access just what is true. As we were mentioning the first night, okay, what's true is useful. Okay, let me just see this thing. And many practices access what is true. But the wing of the Dharma has two wings. One is the wisdom component. The other is the compassion or the softness of the heart component. And the bird flies with both wings, not with just one. Let me give you for an example. If you were to say or go up to someone who may have some quality, like maybe they're heavy, and you said to that person, someone asked you how I look, and you would say very bluntly, well, you look heavy to me or something. That can be a sword that cuts the person in two. We can use the truth not for the benefit of those that we are addressing the truth to, but rather as a sword to stab and cut. So the Buddha said, don't say just what is true, say what is true and useful. When he put on that second qualifier, suddenly the bird has two wings. Because you don't just say what the stark, naked truth is to someone. You consider the ability of that person to hear that truth. You consider the timing of the equation of that truth and see whether it's the right time, whether it can be said gently enough so that the person can hear it, and so that the whole thing has a component of compassion within it. You see? So when we walk into the room of our minds, we have to be very aware of the compassionate element with which we see things. It's my anger. That may be the truth, but you're bringing anger to that vision, to that observation. And your anger at seeing your anger just perpetuates the conditioning of anger within the room, because you're not out of the room. You're in the room with the anger. It's not like you're outside looking in at the mind. You are part of the mind. And being part of the mind, anything you bring to the mind is the mind. Okay, so that puts a whole new component here on this. Now, let me look around and see just what I see. And just bring my attention, my caring. The Buddha said, hold yourself like a mother would hold her only son, her only child. I'll tell you a story. I had a friend whose sister was 42 years old and had been trying her whole married life to conceive a child unsuccessfully. Have I told you this story? At age 42, she successfully conceived, only to find out at that age that she had breast cancer as well. She decided not to undergo any treatment for breast cancer because she was afraid that the effects of that treatment would affect the fetus of the fetus. So she decided to forego the treatments of radiation and chemotherapy. At the end of 9 months, she delivered a baby, healthy baby boy, only to find out that her breast cancer had metastasized and the doctors were only giving her a couple of months to live. In fact, at that time, she only had 6 weeks to live. Now, I tell that story not to jolt you, but because of what the implications are for someone who only has 6 weeks with something they've longed for their whole life. Do you think that mother missed a single breath of that child's life? And what kind of attention do you think that mother gave her child? Don't you think it was a soft attention, a caring attention? The kind of attention that we all long to have, that would really and actually support us when we did receive it. The kind of ear that you would like someone to listen to you with, that's just there with you and cares by the very ability to hold you within their attention, is a supportive, caring environment. That's exactly what we want to bring to the inside of this room. That same quality of care, that same quality of support for ourselves. It's just that we don't feel deserving of that. We feel so unforgiving of our past that one of the hardest people to bring any supportive affection to is ourselves. And yet that's what we're called upon to do as we enter the room of the mind, because it's the only thing that works. Not because it's somehow New Agey thing to do, it's because it's the only thing that works. It's the only thing that works. The Buddha said, anger never ceases through anger, only through love. Which means when we react with anger from anger, because of anger. We just perpetuate the whole cycle of conflict, like the Middle East. And that's also a true statement internally for us. When we see something within ourselves that we don't like and we respond reactively to what it is that we perceive unfavorably, that reaction actually breeds the same quality, nurtures and strengthens the same quality. So that's an extraordinarily important point. Now, the other thing that keeps us from really focusing in on what is in this room in a meaningful and caring way is that the way we come into the room is not for observation purposes, but for self-improvement. What we really want from this room is to be other than what we see in it. We want to have something, some salvation, some way to wiggle out of this. And many of us approach meditation because we want to escape our skins. And somehow we think that meditation or our spiritual journey will take us from where we are to hopefully something much better than. And we're waiting for that to occur. And you see televangelist priests proclaiming the ideals only to go back into their red light areas on the weekends, tears streaming down their face. So my question then is how, or the attitudes with which we bring into the room are as important as what we see in the room. Because the attitudes, especially if they are about self-improvement, will come into the room not with the keen willingness to observe what is there. Oh, there's my anger. There's my frustration. Over here is my annoyance. And there's my loneliness. When we come in open-heartedly, caring about ourselves, we really want to know what these things are and what they're doing to us, because we have a sense that the facts are friendly if we just include and open to them just as they are, and that maybe our salvation is not in improving away from that fact, my loneliness, my fear, but in embracing it fully, completely. And what keeps us from embracing it fully is that we constantly idealize where our spiritual journey is going. And we do this because we are so out of balance all along the way. We think in terms of our disadvantaged sense of self. We see somebody on the street and we look into their eyes in kind of a bewildering manner and say to ourselves, I wonder what he or she wants from me. And then we try to adjust ourselves psychologically to fit the profile of our projection. Well, maybe they would like a more humorous person, and then we try to be funny, or more serious person, or this kind of person, or that kind of person, with that internal commentary, never settling on the person that is there, but trying to sort of smooth it, make it better, make it more appealing. Haven't we all had that feeling? And so that we can't settle with any sort of authenticity, because we don't feel authentic in ourselves. Because when we look at ourselves, we don't see anything holy in us. How can there be holiness in my lust? How can there be holiness in my rage? You don't know what I did to my brother when I was small. There's nothing holy about that. And so we approach the whole sense of ourselves as being very profane and ordinary and disadvantaged. And yet, it has been none of those things. Everybody's mind, I don't have to go ask everybody to know this. Everybody's mind has the same tendencies to self-blame, to condemn, to hate themselves, whether they manifest that or not depends upon the culture and environment in which they live. Everybody has the tendency or movement towards lust, towards rage, towards loneliness. The contents may be different between one human being and another, but the common consciousness of human being contains all of that. And what we're trying to do as we enter this room is to find something authentic. What's authentic is what is there, not idealizing something else or another whole set of cards to be dealt. I'm throwing this hand in. Deal me again. Same cards. Old maid each time. So what do? Since, okay, this is what's in me, it's also in you, what do we do about that? Try to get rid of them, push it out the door? No, because that aversive tendency, that reactive avoidance, stimulates, encourages, and strengthens the same tendency. So I can't do that. So what do? I can't push it out. I can't claim that I have a prettier interior than you do, because virtually the interiors have the same propensities. What do? I examine what is there without idealizing them, without, oh, I wish that weren't there. Just seeing it. As soon as we see it, and this is an important point, because we don't get this, we don't understand it, we just keep butchering ourselves internally, whipping ourselves, beating ourselves up. When I see something, when something is seen, when my anger is seen, when I just allow the anger to be there, it essentially does nothing, can do nothing to me. It can only do something to me if I'm afraid of it. If I go in and think, oh my God, it's my anger, I've got to get rid of or get over that anger. Then I've made the anger a problem, and because I can't get rid of it, it stays a problem. I may suppress it, I may try to push it out, I'm not going to be able to do it, but I may become so rigid in my wanting to do it that the anger will just percolate out as depression or something else. It's like a tire that has a bulge in it, and you just push, pull, tighten it here, and it comes out there. We can't get rid of anything. And so I have to change strategies. Change strategies. And this is the... Christ said something in the Gospel of St. Thomas. He says, if you bring forth what is within you, what you bring forth will free you. If you do not bring forth what is within you, what you do not bring forth will destroy you. That's what we're saying. That's exactly what we're saying. If I just admit that the fact is friendly, no matter what that fact is in this room, no matter what I see, no matter how terrible or discouraging or how historically charged it may be, because my father was angry and look what he did to me, if I can just hold it with the lamp of my attention, I am giving that mind state, I am neutralizing that mind state and its power over me. If I'm afraid of it or react to it or try to hide from it or push it away, I'm giving it much more control to loom behind me unconsciously so that I act out that mind state because I'm identified with it. But if I see it for what it is and do nothing about it, doing nothing about it doesn't mean you whitewash it and turn your head away. You look at it. You know that it's there. And therefore you have made mindfulness a component part of it. It has no control whatsoever. None. Okay. And that is the most loving thing, because this is a talk on compassion and care, that is the most loving thing that we can do to ourselves. Is it loving to come in here with an idealized concept of how you should be and try to generate that ideal against all the known facts of how you really are, is that loving? Or is it loving to come into the room and say, just this, just this, just this, okay, just this, I can feel this. Okay, I can hold this, this is okay. Do you feel the difference? All you need is one insightful glance into the power of what it really means to hold yourself with affection, with a caring attention, and you'll never go back and believe the opposite. Now let me go a step further and tell you how compassion arises in the heart. Compassion is the normal and natural response of the heart to pain. When we see someone hurting or we see ourselves hurting, the natural response of the heart is to open to that individual who's in pain or myself who's in pain. So if that's the fact, and there is so much pain in the world, why is there so little compassion? You would think that if there was so much pain in the world, and the compassion was a product of just seeing that pain and being able to allow it and to hold it, then everyone would be compassionate. The problem is, and the reason that there's so little compassion, is that we can't hold pain. We avoid pain. When pain arises, we want out. When somebody's grieving, we want them to get over their grieving. Get on with it. Get on with your life. Go back to work. Because we can't hold the thought of grief in ourselves. And therefore, compassion can't arise because we aren't in touch with suffering, with pain. If we're willing to just hold it, okay, which also is what everyone who's in pain most dearly wants, then our response to the world will be one of heartfelt compassion and affection. But you know what? It's hard. And when we open, and when the heart is open like that, it feels very vulnerable. It feels very raw. It feels as if this is going to blow me out of the waters. I would go out to the home of dying people, and the one that was the most difficult for me was the mother, young mother usually, who was dying with two small children. And I would think these children are never going to know or fully what a life with their natural mother is like. And that would just, and I couldn't. So I would go out to the house, and I would be full of the rage against God or whoever for doing this, and I would be how unfair it was and how unjust. And finally, one person said to me, you know, you come out here so angry at my situation, you're not available for me at all. You see? You go out there, and you're just with the person, regardless of the conditions around that person, and you just hold their pain, and that's where people want to be. That's what we're most of us cry out for, that kind of attention, that kind of support, unconditional support, where someone is willing to reside in the environment, the same environment, the same internal environment that I'm having. Your ability to reside, or my ability to reside with you in that internal environment of pain, is what people most want when they're afflicted. When somebody's dying, there's nothing we can do about the fact that they're dying, when they've exhausted all cure. And you're out there and you want to do anything but be with that person who's dying, because dying is a very personal state to all of us. And so the person who is dying wants nothing more than to have company. And the person who's out there wants nothing less than to be with this person in death. So I'll do things for you. Would you like your newspaper? Let me get you a cup of tea. Would you like some more ice in your water? You see? That is exactly the same response, exactly the same response that we need internally for ourselves. The ability to come in without judgment, without prejudice, without a historical reaction to what it is that's in here, and just observe, to hold ourselves exactly as we would hold the most needy among us. Okay. I can feel this in myself. We say yes to the interior of the room. Meditation can be distilled down into two things. Relax and say yes. Open yourself. Open yourself to what is happening here. Don't create another problem with the problem that's already engendered. Don't create more turmoil, more reaction, more self-belligerence, more condemnation and self-dislike when you enter this space. This space demands the best from you. That's why meditation can go off in two directions. It can foster and encourage exactly from whence you've come. And 5 years from now, you'll find yourself quite likely becoming more embittered and cynical. Or it can foster an open heart. It depends on what you bring to the observation. Let us understand this principle. And you can use it regardless of the religious tradition from whence you come. I'm not just talking about the principles of Buddhism here. I'm talking about the basis for all spiritual growth. This is how it occurs. Because there's only one way the mind works. It doesn't work differently for a Christian than it does for a Buddhist. There is only the mind of the human being, and our job is to discover, not according to how the culture tells us to be, because the culture isn't even on board with this. They aren't even on the playing field. As a matter of fact, they want intentionally to keep you off the playing field, because this is the most threatening thing that you can do. Why is it threatening? Because it turns the whole culture upside down. Because when we come into the room and we don't argue with the content, suddenly there is a wholeness of heart, a wholeness of heart that is available. And in that wholeness, stillness, the quietness, the union, there is a sensing of interconnectedness, of something far more enticing than the individuality and separation from whence we have come. And this then is the mystical quality of all traditions, where you see that what we have called and claimed ownership of as being I, me, and mine is jointly shared. But more importantly, there's a sense of space of moving out beyond just one's individuality to a sense of union, of interconnection with all beings. This is the way of the practice. This is the way of the heart. This is the way of meditation. We come in, we quiet, we relax. The relaxation itself is a key, because relaxation allows the dissipation of any attitude even before we get going. We're having a bad day. In the relaxation, the bad dayness can't sustain itself. We have to release ourselves from the burden of that day in order to be relaxed. So the attitude can't follow us into relaxation. That's why I keep reinforcing the need to relax every time you sit down and every time your mind gets lost in thought. Because when you bring your mind back from having been lost in thought, you may well be condemning yourself for being lost in thought. And then you will follow that self-condemnation back with your breath or whatever it is that you're observing, reinforcing the same sense back into yourself. You see? It's a closed loop. So we do nothing except observe and see with caring attention. With caring attention. Thank you. So we'll sit for a minute or two and just be quiet together. Just allowing the words now to fall away. And just for a moment, as we become quiet together, let yourself be still. Stillness is the indication that we are not reacting to anything that's inside of us. And you can begin to sense from that stillness, from that quietude, a richness, a profound sacred richness that intimates something more than what we have thought ourselves to be. Just feeling it. Just a sense of it. Don't brush it away as, oh, that's... Now that we have finished our walking, the last half an hour I would like to divide into 15 minutes of questions and answers, and the last 15 minutes will be a metta meditation. Metta meditation, M-E-T-T-A, is a loving kindness meditation, and it's an adjunct, a complement to the Vipassana meditation that we're doing. And if you stay within this tradition, you will hear the word over and over again, loving kindness, metta. It's the foundation of the second wing of the bird. So I'm going to be teaching that tonight, so we'll have a shortened question and answer. But before we get to the question and answers, the homework. The homework on the compassion homework of the handout, please apply yourself to that if you would. But here's an additional task for you. Do one thing kind for yourself every day. One thing. Buy yourself flowers. Take a walk in the woods. Just for you. Purposefully doing something just for you that's kind. Not self-indulgent, not eating a hot fudge sundae. I mean, that may be kind, but it's quite likely indulgent. But doing something that nourishes you. So that's your homework, along with the sheet sitting 30 minutes a day, and finding a fourth marker. Now, is there anyone that I don't have to explain another again what a marker is, right? So, sit 30 minutes a day. I hope everyone has developed some sort of routine. Don't get too anxious or gets, oh, I can't do that. You know, it's just too much in my life. Okay, it's okay. If you miss it, you know, it's okay. Just let in as much as you can let in. And give yourself as much focus and commitment to whatever you let in as possible. And it will have its own effect upon you. In fact, what I'm trying to do is to get you to a certain point where the Dharma hook is in you, where you see and understand in a verified kind of way the purpose and point of living a life with greater awareness and aliveness. In whatever tradition you're in, I'm not trying to sell you Buddhism, but I am trying to sell you awareness. And so you need to have had a certain level of experience before you bite on the hook. Up until that point, it's like, oh God, I got to sit again. Oh geez, I can't do this. This is too, it's like all uphill, right? But there is that moment when you can actually ski, when you've learned, had your lessons, when you're fallen 10,000 times, and you can actually, whoa, I did it, right? Then the Dharma hook will be in. And that's where I want to take you. So then you'll never be able to unhook yourself. So, questions or comments? Got anything? She forgot what a marker was. A marker is a pause that you give yourself, that you, something, because it's something you do every day, where you pause before you do it. And then you then do whatever you're going to do from that sense of collectedness. So there's the brush. You brush your hair every day. Comb your brush your teeth, comb your hair. There's the brush. Before you, okay, pause. Now pick up the brush and brush your hair from that sense of collection, collectedness. And find, we have four of them, and we're going to piece them throughout the day so that they begin to affect the day. Any other questions? Yes.
It's about the going to the room. Okay, so the point is we don't head for the room. While we're sitting, while we're breathing, we veer off and we end up in the room. And that's the point at which you just bring your attention to whatever it is you see. In other words, you don't want this little division between the room.
No. The question is...
You just go in there. You end up in there while you're trying to breathe.
Well, you're... The question... If I can find my flashlight, there it is. The question is about getting in the room and finding ourselves in the room and going on a mission to discover the room. You're always in the room. You can't get out of the room. Okay. Right? But what we're doing is mostly we don't see the room at all. Mostly we see just a blur like this. I'm on my breath. What breath? What are you talking about? I slow down and say, what? And it's like looking out the side window of a car. So we're trying to orient you to the front window of the car so that you can, yes, I'm angry or I'm annoyed. So that you know what's there, that you know what's passing through, okay?
This is at the point at which you are sitting. You're sitting.
I'm talking about the point that you are sitting. First, you need to sustain your attention on something so that you're steady enough to even know that you're in the room. You've always been in the room, but now you know you're in the room. But first you've got to be able to steady yourself on something long enough to get that established fact. Because you can't see anything if your mind is moving so rapidly. And what it's moving to is thought, thinking about this. So thought, you don't have to care about what's in here. You just think about the thought. The thought is an abstraction. It's floating through here. It has nothing to do with the truth of what's in here. It has everything to do with just some abstract concept. And we're so used to abstracting ourselves one moment to the next, we need to base ourselves on what's actually underneath the concept, what's actually occurring in this room, despite our need or willingness to divulge, to just indulge in thinking. Right? So first we need to steady ourselves. We do that by following the breath, slowing ourselves down, sustaining our attention. And then from that ability of sustained attention, we can then go out and observe other things that are arising that predominate within this room. So we're doing it very slowly, very meticulously, one sensation at a time. We're not going, I know it now, I can leave. It's like, okay, breath. Oh, I'm feeling a pain in my knee. Okay, pain in my knee. Oh, God, I don't like it. I'm afraid of this pain. Okay, fear. Fear, okay, now I can go back to pain. Now the pain isn't bothering. Okay, breath in, rising, falling. I've got an itch. Oh, it's that damn, I get so irritated when those mosquitoes, okay. Irritation, you see? Stay very clear, very concise, very exact. Know what you're aware of every single moment. And soon, instead of just, wait, soon, instead of just a flashlight, the room will light up on its own. You'll know everything that's happening in the room automatically, because you won't be afraid of anything. It's the fear that keeps you bound to a corner. So just follow these instructions just as I'm giving them to you. Don't go out. Don't try to do next week's before this week. Every single, it has a point, a purpose. It's well established. Just follow it. It'll work. Yes.
I had a real hard time, dealing with emotion, but separating the emotion, the feeling, from the context of the feeling, from the
content. Yes. So the question is about the emotion, an emotion and the content of the emotion, the difficulty in being able to separate those things out. Well, know that one is the emotional tone. Right? It has a physical sensation to it. It has, like when you're angry, right? Now, the component part of that experience is thoughts which perpetuate that anger, justify that anger. I'm angry because, often blame, right? So there's a component to every emotion which charges and fuels that emotion. So instead of leaning into what we usually do is we don't spend much time focusing on the emotion. We spend most of the time on the justification, because the justification excuses me from having to feel the feeling. If it's not because I did something, it's because you did something, then I don't have to take responsibility or be accountable to the feeling, you see? So in this way, we want to put less of our emphasis of our attention on the justification, the rationale, the content, and more on the experience of what it actually feels like. The content will continue to capture your attention, but just don't give it any emphasis. Keep coming back to base ourselves in the actual physical sensations of the emotion and the mind state of the emotion without the accompaniment. And really, thought and emotion are juxtaposed in such a way that they can't be completely extracted from one another, right? So, but we're not to the point where we're able to meditate and know that we're thinking yet. We're not there. That's a couple of weeks away. But we'll get there. Yes. 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 So this question has to do with two different things coming up at the same time where you're on your breath, rising, falling, but also thinking, boy, I can't wait until breakfast. It was a great night last night. I had a lot of fun. Rising, falling, right. Okay, so very common and very genuine question. When you catch yourself multitasking, make the decision. Do you see that you can see me and also look at me, but you can also see what's behind me even as you look at me, can't you? But you can make a decision or a commitment to spend for your energy to be on what on the side of me as opposed to what's behind me. Or you can make a decision to look, even as you're looking at me, to really have your focus on what's behind me. Can't you? So you have that ability to bring figure or ground into perspective and to choose which one. Choose the figure of the sensation, not the ground of the thought. The thought, the abstraction, gives you a sense that you're on it, and you'll be, well, I'm doing it, but I can think too, so I can enjoy myself even as a... Right? So you want to just, okay, so see, realize that that's a trick the mind is doing, and just, okay, just as much as I can, take a formal posture, put my hand on my abdomen, and recenter myself onto what this practice is, which means that I just have ears for one thing, just the sensation of my breath, just the pain in my knee, okay? It's like if we only had 1 minute to live, if somehow we knew that the world was going to explode and we had 1 minute to live, you wouldn't even have time to call home on your cell phone, what would you do? What would that 1 minute be like? Your life would be so interesting to you that you would be instantly mindful. Right? There wouldn't be breakfast that was going to happen. It would be... That's what we're bringing ourselves into, the same aliveness, the same focused interest really, on what is occurring. And we have to learn our way into that interest because we are bred towards thinking our interest is only in our thinking. And so our thinking, well, I'd rather think. I don't want to go back to my breath. I want to think. Thinking is more interesting. It's more pleasant. So you have to retrain that. Good. Yes.
My question follows on the heels of this challenge. This week was very challenging for me, bringing the emotional component into the practice, and I was challenged by separating the content from the emotion. And when I would get to that place where I just sat with the emotion, it would manifest sometimes as physical discomfort, and it would shift, and it would get really even more uncomfortable.
Yes.
And I wasn't sure whether to go with that or try to, I wasn't right. Sure.
Yes, very good. First of all, I would suggest getting a mentor, because such a situation would be very helpful to have somebody to call rather than having to wait until Monday or Tuesday to come back in. But the question has to do about when you open to emotions, you unleash or you release a lot of energy associated with that, as well as a lot of thought or a lot of discomfort can come. There can be what we call in the business a multiple hindrance attack. So you're restless and you're feeling the emotion, and your emotion is coming up and you don't want the emotion, I don't like the emotion, and I don't know what to do, and the breath is coming, and you're irritable, and I don't know, the whole thing just feels like...
I was praying for physical pain.
Right, something. Physical pain, pray for physical pain. Okay, so the practice... Stay simple and easy. I'm giving you the lineage of the practice. This is one, two, this is three or four lineage, my teacher's teacher's teacher, right? Simple and easy. Stay simple and easy. Okay. If you have to open your eyes, what is predominant in my experience? Just let me go there. Be very simple, very straightforward. Don't get lost up in all the competing, and sometimes the emotion is so strong or so intense, need to just get up. Sort of, okay, let me just, right? The intensity is partially fed by a fear that we're going to be overwhelmed by it. That if, whoa, this is getting, you know, I thought this thing would go away when I started watching it. It doesn't necessarily go away right away. It can get very intense, but you still have the ability, or the mind, the awareness, still has the ability to hold or to accommodate it. It just has to learn how to accommodate it by learning that it is inherently safe to accommodate. And you just haven't, we haven't spent enough time with it to understand sufficiently that it is safe. And over time you will. So just give yourself a little rub up against it so that you know that, you know, you can feel a little bit, okay, I can stay a little bit in this. And then if it gets too powerful, just change postures again. Yeah, yeah, good, good question. Now I want to stop the questions. I appreciate all of your questions and I appreciate your sincerity. But I want to have us do a metta meditation for the last 15 minutes. So if you wouldn't mind taking a formal posture, take one in which you are, there's nothing, you're not hurting. There's nothing hurting. If that means, that means bringing in 6 inches of foam next week.
Three Tylenols.
Okay, so just again, we want to do everything just as we have done this for Vipassana. Let me just explain metta for a minute. So let me just have your attention. You can open your eyes. Metta is a systematic way of taking the deepest heart's intentions for oneself to be happy, to be content, to be free of pain, and to honor and direct and intend those things so that we say deliberately certain phrases and we'll repeat certain phrases. And I'll want you to make up your own phrases, but I will give you phrases until you're able to make up your own phrases. May I have ease and well-being. May I be free of fear. May I be safe and free of danger. Those are the phrases that we'll be using. And we'll just intone those, direct those with the intention to establish that quality or just wish ourselves those qualities because we're deserving of them. Everybody's deserving of a safe and fearless and easy life. Easy doesn't, I don't mean ease of well-being, an eased life. And then we take those same wishes, those same intentions, and we spread them out to all beings. And we go through a very systematic way of doing that, which we don't have time tonight, where we first send those phrases to ourselves and then to some benefactor and then to a friend and then to a neutral person and then to a difficult person and then to all beings. Tonight we'll work on self, and we'll work on benefactor, and then we'll work on all beings. Okay? So I'll lead you through it now. So just close your eyes. Relax. Establish your attention on your breath. Release yourself from the whatever you've been thinking or carrying for this period. Now focus your attention on the center of your chest, right in the energetic heart area, not the physical heart, but the energetic heart, as if you could breathe through that heart. Let the breath be in the center of your chest, as if you could breathe right through your heart, the energetic heart. In breath, out breath. And let the heart soften with each passing breath. Let it soften. Let it release its tension. Sometimes that tension has grief. It doesn't matter. Whatever you're feeling is fine, or feeling nothing is fine. But let the heart soften. And as the heart softens, let words form around that softening, such as, may I be safe and free of danger. May I be free of fear. May I have ease and well-being. What's important is the intention to direct those phrases, kind-hearted phrases, to yourself, whether you feel deserving of them, whether you feel open to them, doesn't matter. Just have the intention, set the intention. May I be safe and free of danger. May I be free of fear. May I have ease and well-being. And feel the meaning of those phrases and send them to the very cells throughout your body. As if every cell was hearing the message, may I be safe and free of danger. Feel the cells receive that. May I be free of fear. May I have ease and well-being. May I be safe and free of danger. Sending, radiating, allowing the heart to radiate out, to share the message of goodwill throughout your body. Doesn't matter what you're feeling or what you're thinking. Have the intention to do this. May I be free of fear. May I have ease and well-being. Now I want you to picture a benefactor, someone who has done something very kind for you, has helped you along the way, has nourished you at a time when you were needy. Someone in which there's a very clear appreciation. And have them sit right in front of you, knee to knee, chest to chest, facing one another, and feel the heart connection between yourself and that person. Just let the heart, now you want that person to be safe and free of danger, so let the heart express itself with the same intentionality. May you be safe and free of danger. May you be free of fear. May you have ease and well-being. Feel them receiving your well wishes. May you be safe and free of danger. May you have ease and well-being. May you be free of fear. Just let those phrases again and again move from one's heart outward to the benefactor's heart. Now let the benefactor fade, yet keep your heart open, and move the spirit and energy of wishing well out like an overflowing well. May all beings be safe and free of danger. May all beings be free of fear. May all beings have ease and well-being. Across the landscape and through the trees and over the ocean, covering and blanketing the world in this desperate time, let us just sit in that absolute commitment of wishing people well. May all beings be safe and free of danger. May all beings be free of fear. May all beings have ease and well-being. Without discrimination, without selection, blanketing the world. All beings. All beings. May all beings be safe and free of danger. May all beings be free of fear. May all beings have ease and well-being. So I'd like you to practice that this week, just according to the sheet that's there, a few minutes. You can take 10 minutes in the first part of the sitting or the last part of the sitting. And it's the hardest thing to do is to send one's... It's so amazing. The Buddha said you could look throughout the lands and find no one more deserving of loving kindness than yourself. And yet it's the last person who we feel deserving of that kind of attention and that sort of affection. And so once we have established the intention, I'm going to offer this to myself. I don't care what I'm feeling, what objections I put up. This is the way. This is the way. This is what ultimately, regardless of what my mind says I deserve this. So let me set that intention. Let me get it going. Let me set it forth. Let me put my whole weight and intention upon it. And may it be so. So that's the compassion meditation. Now, at the end of the course, I will give a book list of reading, one of which is Sharon Salzberg's book, Loving Kindness. And she teaches loving kindness, and in fact, she's going to be here in Seattle in November doing a non-residential for all of us who would like to come. So that's something I'll talk about the last week of this retreat. But for now, we're going to start practicing it as part of the complement of the other practice. It brings out the heart element. It brings out the consideration and intention to consider yourself when you're moving into the room of the mind. That this needs to have that balance, or the room of the mind can get haunted. unless we move with loving kindness. So that's the intention of it all. And may you all be filled with loving kindness. Thank you this evening, and don't forget your homework. And if you don't mind not forgetting the Donna basket, I would appreciate it. And yes, last one.
I just wanted to let anyone know who might be interested. Tonight through Thursday night are the final nights at the Varsity Theater. The movie Siddhartha, based on Hermann Hesse's book Siddhartha, is playing. And it's not available on video. It's beautifully shot in India.
Thank you. And did you want to, just before, could people just stay for just one more minute? She lives on Capitol Hill, and if anybody's going to... Okay, there we go. Great. Thank you all. See you next week. Don't forget the homework.